This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you during a time when everything seems a little different in light of this coronavirus pandemic. Some of the most encouraging news in the midst of all the tragic developments has come from our World War II vets when we hear that they've been able to overcome this awful virus. Like Army vet Bill Lapshees, who recovered from COVID-19 and got to celebrate his 104th birthday this week in Oregon. In light of these coronavirus concerns, I'm not currently able to go out and meet with veterans in person. Over the years, we've done a few of these interviews over the phone when necessary, but it's always better in person. It sounds better. I know it's easier for a veteran to trust someone sitting right in front of them. So as I've put these in-person visits on pause for a while, it's created another opportunity to look at some 75th anniversaries. And in digging back through our archives, I was really struck by how many vets we've met over the years who survived kamikaze attacks at Okinawa. There were other heroics during that 82-day battle that we've heard about, and in addition to what happened, sometimes it's just as interesting and eye-opening to hear about what almost happened but didn't. Those moments that left so many veterans feeling, as my grandfather was fond of saying, that they were living on borrowed time. Such was the case 75 years ago this week on the historic Coast Guard cutter Roger B. Taney for a 21-year-old from Oklahoma by the name of Jim Kitchen.
In Okinawa, I guess it's just one time, it was nighttime. We'd been at general quarters several times, but we had left Okinawa and go to these, there was a few miles over, it was a lot of little islands there, kind of protected, to get supplies, and a Japanese fighter plane came through the harbor, and he must have done a barrel roll, and just the sound of the engines made my knees get weak.
Where were you on the ship when this was happening?
Oh, I was sitting back on the aft deck just looking around.
So you saw this Japanese plane and...
No, it was dark and you couldn't see it. It just made the noise. This is at nighttime.
So you heard it and that got your attention a little bit.
Just the roar of the engines when they, like you do a barrel roll, and it just, I don't know what it did, but never fired a shot or dropped a bomb.
But that wasn't the only time there was a plane headed toward your ship. Okinawa is infamous for the amount of kamikazes in and around that battle. And your ship became a target for one of them?
Yes, we had a plane come in. It was raining, and he came in, and he's coming down our starboard side, and we started shooting at him all the way around, and he got to the port side, broadside to us, and I was the trainer on the gun. I run the gun fore and aft, you know.
Yeah, explain to us how that works. Most people listening have never been on a ship with a gun like this. It takes more than one person to make this gun work and actually have it do what it's supposed to do.
There is a trainer and a pointer, and the trainer runs the gun around, and the pointer up and down, and he pulls the trigger. And then we have ammunition handlers, and then we have projectile and a hot shellman. He catches the brass container when it comes out and throws it away.
And how big are these projectiles?
It's called a 5-inch 38. The projectiles are 5 inches, and they're about 16 inches long, and I'd say the powder can was about 30 inches, so it did make quite a noise.
Yeah, quite a noise, pretty heavy to handle, and obviously can do a fair amount of damage. So you said you're the trainer on this gun, so it's your job to aim this gun side to side.
That is correct, and there's pointers, it's coming from radar, that we have to follow. It's kind of fun to do it. If the ship is rolling, you learn just to roll with the waves and keep it there.
Yeah, easier said than done. So, but I imagine it gets pretty tense. I mean, firing that gun in practice is one thing, but when there's a plane heading your way that could crash into your ship and do a whole lot of damage, then this isn't fun and games anymore. Do you remember how that all happened, what it felt like, and how it unfolded?
Well, you know, we were just young kids. They were so many of them they were picking out the larger ships. I saw 9 ships get kamikazes in one day. We were hoping that they'd get close enough that we could shoot at them. But then if we did, we had to help the gunner's mates clean the gun up, the barrel, wash it out, oil it.
And can you maybe help us understand how difficult this is with the plane moving that fast at the altitude where it is? With, you know, having to have this teamwork on the gun, how difficult it was to actually shoot one of these guys down?
Well, it, it was just luck, because radar tells you how fast they're going and the altitude they're going. And for a plane to be coming down about, say, 300 miles an hour, and you're going to put a projectile in that gun and set the fuse setting that it will go off whatever you set it for, like 2 seconds, 2,000 feet. And with a plane coming down, and then the time that you get all that information and put it in, and it explodes right in front of him, and he rolls over and crashes into the water. It's just, how do you do it?
And you kind of stated that like it's a hypothetical, but that's what actually happened. That's what you guys were able to do to take out that kamikaze.
That is correct. Okay, I'll tell you what I said then. When I stopped moving the gun and I just sitting still, I knew something was wrong. I looked up and I saw the plane coming down on us, and the pointer was Tex. And I said, Tex, if you ain't had the pointers matched, get them matched, because he's coming in. And the gunnery officer must have heard me. It was an open mount gun, and he was kind of standing behind me. So he went around and put that 2-second fuse setting on it. And when that one went off, it exploded right in front of the plane, and it crashed in the water 1,000 feet behind us.
What do you think would have happened if that fuse hadn't been set like that? If it hadn't, if the points hadn't been matched up, if it didn't explode right when and where it did?
Well, if it hadn't, it looked like he was looking down our gun barrel, and I wouldn't be here today. But I don't know, the ammunition handlers, they got scared and run forward, but I sat there and I don't know, I didn't. But when I saw the explosion in front of him, I sure felt good though.
I don't want to exaggerate here, but it sure sounds like you're saying for you guys to put that shell right there and have it explode right there was a bit of a needle in the haystack. And if you hadn't found that needle in a haystack, then y'all would have been dead.
That is correct. I feel that way. We wouldn't be here right now talking.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic or get you to say anything that you don't really feel. But when you think about that moment, because that's significant to me, and I've interviewed so many veterans who have moments like that, how do you account for that? The fact that it happened just that way and you're still here talking to me right now?
Well, you know, I never thought about it after I went home, and I haven't talked about it much until here, just the later years that we've had so many reunions with my shipmates, got together and got to talking and realized what really happened.
So you guys shot down a kamikaze, but that wasn't the only thing that was shot down by your ship, and sometimes it was hard to know who was coming at you. You guys actually shot down an American plane, is that right?
Yes, it came over the island the same way as the first kamikaze that we shot down, and they wouldn't identify themselves. So after they got in over the ships that were anchored in there, we shot him down. After we shot that one down, then a two-motor Betty bomber was coming in just over the water, real close, and it got within 1,000 feet of us before the forward guns knocked it down, and it cleaned the deck of a freighter 1,000 feet in front of us. We had a pretty good gun crew, because when we making those trips to North Africa, they sent us up on the east coast there a little ways, and we would have gunnery practice, and the planes would drive fly a sleeve by, and we'd shoot at it, and they got unhappy with us, because every time they come by, we shot it down, they had to go back and get another one.
Let's get back to that American plane you shot down. Were you guys able to determine whether that was actually an American crew on that plane, or that maybe it was Japanese soldiers who had stolen an American plane?
Well, the only thing that they could find out, that there was no planes missing on any airstrips or aircraft carriers, and so they just were very sure then it was a stolen plane that they captured on one of the islands, and they came over and they couldn't identify themselves.
Well, and those must have been some tense moments, because they had a chance to identify themselves, and I'm sure everybody on ship is hoping they will, because you don't want to be firing at a plane with American markings.
I was watching as it came over the land, and it got to the ships, and it got past a few of them, and still wouldn't identify themselves. And so that's when the ship took action, the forward guns, and before it got very far.
Don't hear a story like that every day, do you? That was Coast Guard veteran Jim Kitchen remembering some of his close calls at Okinawa. For Wyoming native Bob Ashburn, he hadn't quite reached his 20th birthday, but he'd already survived 8 invasions. With enough close calls to earn his ship, the destroyer escort USS Tisdale, the nickname Lucky T.
My gut tied up in a knot. Some guys showed stuff outwardly. And boy, they're smoking cigarettes. I never smoked, but they were just puffing on those cigarettes. I don't know what they're getting out of it. I never showed anything outwardly, but my gut was tied up in knots from nerves, I guess.
When the kamikazes came, can you paint a picture for us? Can you tell us what you saw?
Basically, they were after those carriers. I could show you some numbers in here. You know, we're not talking about, like, I hear about these few strikes they're doing over in the Mideast. We're talking about several hundred planes a day. Now, the fleet is broke up into so many pieces. Like, let's say when we was working with carriers, there'd be six carriers and about, 15, 18 escort ships all the way around them. The reason for that, whenever they decided to launch into the wind, they had protection no matter which way you turned. The closest one, I thought, oh, hey, and I'll back up. But this was the one that really, this guy was coming on to us from astern. That's the least way we could get any firepower going. And we're back there standing up. Here's his depth charge racks and there's two guys here. And that bucker was coming in on us. Oh, man, this we're finally going to get us. But about maximum 50 yards away, that guy was still coming down on us and strafing us. And you look up there and you see on his wings just sparks coming off. Looks like sparks coming off there. But and, of course, that's to, you know, try and knock down our guys. When you see that, and about 50 yards away, I said, oh, boy, he was coming head on into us. But we got a direct hit, must have hit on his bomb, because that plane just blew up and throwing, you know, parts of it, splashing all around us, but he didn't make it there. Then other times, they were pretty close. How we could see there, when you see those sparks coming off their wings, hey, they're, then when you go out and you're hitting them, and you're hitting, you know, some aluminum with this bullet, it's like little white puffs of smoke coming off. When they get in that close, then you know they're getting on you. But as this fleet is, here's this bunch and there's that bunch and that, you know, a few miles apart. But whichever one they picked on, that's the one that caught the worst. You're just hoping they'd pick on somebody else. Now, the next thing a lot of people don't kind of know either, the kamikazes, they were one to chirp. They just went and that was it. But then in these same raids, they'd had their regular Air Force. You know, their bombers, torpedoes. They did their thing and turned around and went back. We're talking hundreds a day. So when I hear about these little airstrikes back in the Far East, it's peanuts. We had hundreds of raids. But there's one time there, we were at general quarters for 40 solid hours. They're trying to get you. You're trying to stop them.
Can't imagine what that feels like. I mean, there's got to be part of you that says, there's no way I'm going to make it through this.
Well, at Okinawa almost constantly. There were so damn many of them, and they just kept coming. They had 2,500 planes, like, lost in just to Okinawa. And you get 2,500 planes, after, you know, your odds get... We just kept thinking, well, hey, now, see, because we lost half of our squadron. We thought, when the hell are we going to be next? But we lucked out.
The lucky T. And you told us about one of those times where you were very fortunate with that kamikaze coming straight at you. He's strafing you. And you said 50 yards away, he blows up because one of your guns hit him?
Yes. On this size ship, the biggest gun was a 3-inch. It had to be a hit from this one aft gun that was shooting back. Now, see, over on the sides of them, they could have the 20s and the 40s pound them, but to blow them up like they did, we figured he had to hit the bomb because, I mean, it just blew up. Hey, and enough, close enough, got slapped in the face from the concussion. When it's like that, it's pretty damn close.
So you felt it. When it exploded, you felt that.
Oh, yeah. Just like slapping you like that.
So a few questions here. A, if that gunner doesn't hit that plane, what would have happened?
It would have wiped out that whole, see, the K guns, four on each side, and then that first, see, that gun that got him, he was one deck up, but it would have wiped them out, too. Hard telling how far, but it, see, that kind of a ship can't take bad damage.
Would you be here? Would you be sitting here talking to me if that guy hadn't shot him down?
No.
What if they had shot him up, but not blown him up? In other words, hit him, disable him, but not explode him.
He would have still went in. Because, see, that was the deal. They knew they was going to get shot at. If they're strafing or anything they're doing, didn't do anything. Because when that plane comes down, say the bomb goes off, the plane crashing into you, and then that gasoline burner. So it's...
Well, I don't want to exaggerate, but I'm just listening to you recount this story, and it sounds to me that that shot that that gunner had on him was kind of a one-in-a-million shot. If he hits him anywhere else on that plane, you're not here.
Yes, most definite. After this is over, this guy's back there talking. He says, hey, that was it. We thought bad. And you go through that day after day.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've heard a lot of different perspectives on this. When you go through something like that, when you live through that and you realize how close you were and how nearly impossible it was for your life to be spared in that moment, yet it still happened, do you feel like someone was looking out for you? Was there someone there protecting you?
I said my prayers every night, and I've said the same prayer ever since. It was just by the grace of God we made it. That's all I can figure. Here, these buddy ships, they're getting wiped out. And you just say, well, we lucked out that time. Lucky to you.
Navy veteran Bob Ashburn remembering his close calls off of Okinawa. It's time for another break, but more similar stories to come as we keep that time machine dialed in at 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.